Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1970s and 80s, American distance runners led the pack year after year in big marathons. The winner's circle was theirs. Then something happened. In 1983, there were 267 U.S. men who broke 2 hours and 20 minutes in a marathon. In 2000, that number was down to 27. And Kenyans, Ethiopians, and others had long since taken the lead. Now there's an effort to make Americans distance champs again, maybe to re-engineer their form. This hour On Point, bringing back the American distance runner. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Jennifer Kahn. Her big piece in the November 8th issue of The New Yorker is The Perfect Stride: Can Alberto Salazar Straighten Out American Distance Running? Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Portland, Maine, Scott Douglas is here, senior editor at Running Times, just back from the New York Marathon. He's co-author with Olympian Pete Fitzinger of Advanced Marathoning and with long-distance legend Bill Rogers of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Running. We'll hear in this hour from Bill Rogers himself. Scott Douglas, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom.
Give us the latest, Scott. What happened in New York in the big marathon just the last couple of days?
Edison Pena was a big story. No, I'm just kidding. It went pretty much to form in that in sync with what we're talking about here today. American men were not really a factor in the race. A first timer from Ethiopia in his first marathon won probably the biggest marathon in the world.
Right. Shannon Flanagan, American, came in second in the women's, but right. not first there either. How near the top were men in the men's race?
So the top American man was Meb Keflezighi, who won last year. He was sixth. And Dathan Ritzenhain, who Jennifer wrote about in her New Yorker article, was eighth. And he was about 4 minutes behind the winner.
What's the talk in running circles about why this long, it's more than a dry spell now, Scott. We've just kind of fallen off. I mean, you go back to some of the Olympics where we can just barely qualify a couple of marathoners to even run in the Olympics. What happened? What's the big, notion?
The real quick answer would be that professional distance running became an open sport with a lot of money available, a lot of money by East African standards, not a lot of money by American standards. The winners of the New York City Marathon won $130,000. That is, you know, a lifetime's earnings in East Africa. It's not here in the U.S. That's a major incentive.
Jennifer, you've been spending a lot of time with Alberto Salazar. There was a time back in the 80s when first Bill Rogers and then Salazar would knock out those big victories just one after another. How is he looking at this? Is primarily an issue of motivation or something else?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, Tom. I think one of the interesting things is it's not just that runners from other countries have gotten faster. American runners have actually gotten slower.
Yeah.
So no American has run the Boston Marathon as fast as Alberto Salazar and Dick Beardsley did when they ran it back in 1982, 30 years ago. So in terms of how Alberto Salazar thinks about it, I think he thinks that the East Africans have a lot of advantages. As Scott was saying, they certainly have a lot of financial incentive to really train hard. They also have the advantage of growing up at altitude. They grew up running. They might often learn an efficient stride, having to run to school, that sort of thing. And they also have just a lot more numbers. We have a lot of distractions here in the United States. There are a lot of other sports you can do. There are video games you can play. If you're in Kenya or Ethiopia, there are a lot of people who are interested in running, and that's pretty much the one thing they're focused on.
Remind us, Jennifer, when Alberto Salazar was at the top of his running game, just how dominant he was.
It was quite extraordinary. He won Boston and he won New York twice. He was the man back in the day. And interestingly, since we're going to talk about form, one thing we can say about him is that he actually had terrible form, and yet apparently it worked quite well for him.
He was 6'1", pretty gangly. Scott, do you remember the Alberto Salazar form and what people thought of it?
Yeah, he was once described as running like a crab. The sort of common running term would be called sitting in the bucket. He sort of looked like he was sort of half sitting on a stool and sort of making his way down the road. But it worked for a few years, incredibly. And then actually I remember once he had really fallen off his peak, then my friends and I would see him in races and think, really? We used to think this guy was good? Because, yeah, he was not a graceful runner, but dominant there for a few years.
Brought home the gold, was in the winner's circle. Jennifer, now he's at this Oregon project, which Nike, the big sports equipment company, is sponsoring. But it's more than a small deal. It's a big deal. Describe this Oregon project effort for us, Jennifer. And then what is it that turned Alberto Salazar's attention so fiercely to form?
They're both interesting subjects. The Oregon Prod is fascinating. It came out of this frustration with American distance running, and Nike has put a lot of money into it. I was on their campus, and it's a beautiful, lavish campus. It's not devoted only to running, but it's quite spectacular. I described the cross-country running trail they have around their property as looking like it was staged by Pottery Barn. It's this sort of perfect thing with these pale gold wood chips.
Right. Amber chip. This is outside of Portland, Oregon.
Exactly, in mm-hmm. Beaverton, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And they have Alberto's a big believer in every possible advantage, and especially he's kind of a technology aficionado. So among other things, he has to New York, he brought something called a cryo sauna for Dathan Ritzenhain, the American who finished eighth, that super cools his body the day before. And they use all kinds of other things like that. They have a sort of a low-gravity treadmill that you can run in this kind of pressurized pod so that you can get your miles in, but you're not putting as much impact on your knees and other joints is the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a lot of resources there.
But it comes down to form. I mean, a video camera, a sort of slow-mo, looking at what, I don't know, Kenyans do. And then I guess, mm-hmm. as I read you, Jennifer, trying to import that for American runners. What's he seeing? What's he looking at?
Yeah, he's looking at a lot of stuff. So there was a moment, the way this all started was that there was a moment when Alberto Salazar was watching a race on TV, actually, and he noticed that this one particular runner who's very accomplished, he noticed that he was doing something slightly different on what's called his back kick, which is after you've actually struck the ground with your foot,
mm-hmm.
you know, your leg kind of goes out behind you,
sure.
and then you have to drag your heel back in, you know, toward your butt and put your foot down again. And that moment when he's pulling his heel back, he was doing it very quickly. He was retracting it sharply like a piston. And Salazar thought, you know, maybe that's what makes him so fast. Maybe he just gets his foot, you know, back to his body so quickly that he can then take another stride. So he can, you know, have basically more strides per minute. He's not sort of letting that foot trail out behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And that led him into this idea that maybe form is the key. Maybe there are tiny differences like that that we should be harnessing as American distance runners.
Scott Douglas, there's definitely something different going on. When you watch Kenyan runners, Ethiopian, East African, I mean, this is not like the traditional Western, think of the statues of Mercury, you know, delivering FTD flowers or just racing across the sky. That rear leg is way behind. It's what we think of as grace is not what they're winning with. It's this more vertical, piston-like motion where the heel of the foot comes right up to the rear end and then right back down. And there's much more to it as well. I mean, can you see Americans adopting that wholesale as their way of running, Scott?
I think that the best way to answer that would be to say that it wouldn't work very well because people run the way they do in large part because of how their bodies are put together. It's called biomechanics. And on average, an East African runner has longer limbs and just the structure of the leg is different than in a sort of a Western European genetic background. I'm speaking on average. But to think that you could imprint, to think that you could translate what an East African sort of more naturally does to someone with a different body structure, I don't think that would be how we're going to go about getting back on the top of the podium.
But Jennifer, as I read you, that is not unrelated to what Alberto Salazar is putting a lot of effort into doing.
I think that's true. I think he probably takes biomechanics into account. You obviously can't force everybody into a cookie cutter mold and to look exactly like a particular runner that you admire. My guess is that he thinks that there are some universals. There are certain things that we can learn from the runners who are fast, and we may be able to apply them. So one thing he worked on with Dathan, or there's a couple things. There's something known as hip separation, which is basically when that front leg is sort of driving forward when your knee is the leading point. The distance between, you know, sort of your front upper leg and your back upper leg is known as hip separation. If you can extend that, that can potentially be good, make that angle a little wider. And then there's something called elbow drive, which is how far you throw your elbow back when you're running. You're obviously, your fist is sort of moving, you know, pumping back and forth alongside your body. And if you can throw that elbow back a little bit more, it because it sort of that torque passes all the way through your body, it allows you to raise that driving thigh a little bit higher. So I think that that's the kind of thing that he thinks, well, you know, over the thousands of steps that you take in a marathon, maybe little details like that will add up and take a couple minutes off.
What does it mean that Ritzenhain, you know, was back in the pack? I mean, he's been studying with Salazar, but he didn't bring home the winner's crown in New York this weekend.
That's an interesting question, and I bet they're thinking a lot about it. I know that he didn't, because he'd been injured, he didn't have as much time to train up as he would have liked, and he especially didn't have as much time to practice his race tactics because he was injured.
But he may have been injured in part because he's trying this different form. You're right. If I read you correctly, Jennifer. We've got a lot to look at. Let's hold that thought. We'll take a short break here. Come right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're going to hear a little later in this hour from the great American marathoner, Bill Rogers. With us right now, Jennifer Kahn from Berkeley, California. She's a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and a big piece in the November 8th New Yorker magazine, The Perfect Stride, Can Alberto Salazar Straighten Out American Distance Running? And with us from Portland, Maine, Scott Douglas, senior editor at the Running Times. Jennifer, I wish you'd take us through it once more, sort of comparing what we may think of as classic, I don't know, American marathon form with the form that Alberto is pushing toward here. It's more upright. It's more what calf and heel to the rear end on each stride. He's telling his runners, keep your thumbs down. What about the arms themselves, Jennifer, and how that works, how it drives energy in running?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I can talk about the arms. There's also a very fundamental thing, which is for most of us amateur runners, we're probably what's known as heel strikers, which means that we actually land with, we kind of stick our foot out in front of us. Alberto described it as like the keep on trucking guy. We've got that leg stuck out way in front. And then if you do that, it actually means that you're kind of ineffectively breaking yourself with each step. And so one of the very basic things, which is true even for the elite runners, is you don't want to have that heel out in front of you at all. You want the foot to come down directly under, you want it to hit only when it's directly underneath your body. And then he describes the arms. He actually wants, besides the elbow drive, he describes the arms as the fists as going nipple to nipple is how he describes it. He wants the thumbs to be coming up, your right thumb to your right nipple and your left thumb to your left nipple. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to be doing. You don't want to be crossing your arms across your body. You don't want your fist to be down by your hips. And all that, the idea is that because your legs and your arms are linked by the core muscles in your body, how you move your arms actually affects what you can do with your legs, which, of course, are what are powering you through the marathon.
And part of this is as you describe it, perhaps as he describes it, making marathoners run more like sprinters. He talked with Michael Johnson about the four-time Olympic gold medalist about this, about what he was looking at. And Johnson said that's sprinting form.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what's interesting is that the sprinters were onto this a long time ago. Sprinters knew that, you know, you have maybe 20 strides to, you know, cover this 100 yards or whatever. You've got to make every one of them count, probably more like 14 or 15 strides. And so they have actually done stop motion stuff where they film the racers, you know, from the minute they're out of the blocks, they film them in slow motion. They do stop motion capture with just a single frame at a time. And they have tweaked form obsessively. Distance running, for years, no one really thought it mattered. And it's a pretty recent innovation. I would say that Alberto is, he's not one of the first people onto this. They were thinking about it in Europe, you know, 20 years ago. But certainly in America, it was one of the first folks to really begin thinking seriously about it.
Scott Douglas, you were down to see the New York Marathon this weekend. Of course, Dathan Ritzenhine was running there. He was a heel striker. Now he's doing the Salazar way, the East African way. Salazar has told him to, as Jennifer writes, you know, run like you're clawing at the ground. You know, don't use that heel striking. Did you see him in different form in New York, Scott?
I wouldn't say his form looked fundamentally different than it did a couple years ago. The changes that Salazar is trying to make on him are, I think, a lot more subtle. I mean, it's not like he had horrible form before. I mean, he's a former American record holder at 5,000 meters, and he won the bronze medal at the World Half Marathon Championships last year.
He was great, but if you run as a heel striker and your coach tells you to stop that, isn't that pretty fundamental?
Yes, it is, but I'm talking about how he looked running. If you were to perhaps videotape him and analyze it in slow motion, then yeah, it might look a little different. But his basic mechanics of moving down the street to me didn't look all that much different. And I think this is an important point to make, that these changes, if this is what you're trying to do, Dathan Ritzenhine has been running for 12 to 14 years. Yeah. He has tens of thousands of miles in his background, in his sort of these movement patterns have been implanted in him for thousands and thousands of hours. So to fundamentally change something at this point, that would be quite difficult to achieve. So when Ritzenhine starts to tire, especially, his form is going to revert to probably what is its usual, more natural way.
Let's go to Mike in Boston. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask your guests what they think of, the question maybe of nature versus nurture. I suppose somebody out there might almost consider this like, I don't mean to make it a racist question, but isn't it possible that just the muscles are built different in different ethnic backgrounds and there are different kinds of muscle fibers and so forth? Isn't it just possible that just the genetics alone makes some races, so to speak, better at something than others, and perhaps Western Europeans just can't simply be the best at everything? And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, Mike, let me raise it. Jennifer Kahn, what about it? Of course, we saw an Eritrean American do very well in recent years. What does Salazar wonder about that, if it's something in body structure that is related to genetics, not nurture?
I think everybody does. It's one of the big questions, and no one really wants it to be genetics, because then it means that we're really in a hole. It's we're assuming
deal.
That exactly. Like we can train all we want, and we may still not be able to beat anybody. I think the reality is that it's probably a mix. If nothing else, a lot of years of evolution of growing up at altitude alone. The Kenya's Rift Valley is at over 8,000 feet. That may make you more efficient in oxygen uptake. There's all kinds of small advantages you might have. Does that mean that we can never overcome them? I like to think that we have a chance.
What, Tom, can I say something
yes,
real quick
please,
on that?
It's.
So I spent a month in Kenya 6 years ago, and so from the physical standpoint, I mean, you walk around a town of 3,000 people, and 2,900 of them look like they could win the Boston Marathon. I mean, so there's something there.
They're very lean, taut.
Very narrow hips, very long legs in relation to their torso, all that all that stuff. But it's not an either or. I mean, it's sort of a case of 1 + 1 = 3. I mean, you combine that with this incredible motivation, this just unbelievably hard training. We only see the top 10 people out of 100 trying to make a go of it. The other 90 are back home in Kenya, not able to not able to survive the training. So it's 1 + 1 = 3.
I want to get a coach's view here, if I may. Jeremy Rasmussen joins us from Champaign, Illinois. He's in his fourth season as women's cross-country coach at the University of Illinois. He coached cross-country star Angela Bizzari to two NCAA championships before she graduated last spring. He's done very well with his team. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
We're looking at why Americans aren't in the marathoner's winner's circle anymore. You're right in the middle of coaching college students who presumably would, the best of whom would go on to ideally be in that circle. How do you see the problem? What's the matter, Jeremy?
Well, I think that, it's a combination of a lot of things, and I think, some people hit on it a little bit earlier, and I think, it's just a culture. I think the culture over in East Africa is completely different than it is here in the U.S., and And so I think that that's a definite battle that we fight day in and day out as distance coaches or distance runners. And also I think the other thing is, you know, we need to more and more now there's more support for the American distance runners and trying to reach the podium, trying to be the best. And I think that that has come on strong here in the last, 5-10 years. And I think that with that continued support, I think there's been a significant increase in the last, 5 or 10 years and how the athletes have done. Have we made it to the top yet? No. But I think that we're on a continued trend to continue to get better.
Is there a global ideal of form at this point, Jeremy? Is it different depending on body type? Is it different depending on nationality? I mean, is there a form that everybody agrees is the form to be sought?
You know, I think that there's certain aspects of form that you definitely want to pay attention to and try to duplicate the best you can. But at the same time, each individual that you work with as a coach or each individual that's out there running has different aspects that you have to pay attention to, whether it's their skeletal makeup, whether it's their muscular makeup, whether it's, flexibility, strength. There's so many different aspects that go into trying to change form or trying to deal with form that you really have to break it down in an individualized way and figure out what does this specific individual need. You look at some of the great distance runners that are out there. There are some commonalities that are very good that, yeah, we're going to try to duplicate or we're going to try to be able to put together with some of our athletes here in the U.S. But, overall, it has to be an individualized thing, and I think that that's why it takes a while to be able to see change. In the example of what we've done here at University of Illinois, it's taken, it takes anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years to really see a significant difference in how they race. And can they hold that for an extended period of time? And we're only talking over 5 or 10,000 meters. Once you get to the marathon, obviously that's significantly further in distance. And so I think that's going to be, it might take even longer to adapt to that form to be able to hold for 26.2 miles.
We've got a question here from a listener in New York who was just there for the marathon weekend, who says, maybe this is a good question for you, Jeremy. He says, has American running lost its great athletes to soccer programs or somewhere else?
That very well could be the case. And I think that, as a coach, I try to develop athletes first, because you have to be athletic in order to be able to be a great runner, in my opinion. And so, I definitely agree that there are other sports, whether it's soccer, whether it's football, basketball, baseball, whatever the case may be, that are more popular, more mainstream. And that, so, little kids growing up, they want to be a professional athlete in those sports. Most people don't think about being a professional runner. And I think that's definitely something that we do battle with.
Jeremy Rasmussen at the University of Illinois has had a lot of success there, and we wish you more, Jeremy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Now let's go to a great champion. Bill Rogers joins us. Former American record holder in the marathon, won the Boston and New York City marathons 4 times each a generation back. He owns and operates the Bill Rogers Running Center in Boston with his brother, Charlie. Bill, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be on the show.
You were there, you and Alberto Salazar, Joan Benoit, and others, when Americans were again and again in that winner's circle. You must scratch your head and wonder what happened. How do you explain it when people ask, Bill?
I think it's pretty simple, really. To me, it's nuts and bolts, and I see the people who are winning the races are born at altitude. And I don't see them being born at sea level so much, and that's true no matter where you're from, whether it's Mexico or Ethiopia or Kenya or Uganda, wherever in the world, I think. So I think there's a tiny percentage of athletes that are generally, from altitude-born areas. And I think that's a huge factor, huge. And I don't think it's been addressed really within the sport.
So is that about then lung capacity, ability to deal with less oxygen as you run? What's the implication of high-altitude birth?
I think it has to do with a lot of different things, maybe biochemical things and at an enzyme level in the cells of your muscles, but it's cardiovascular too. And of course, all the top runners in the world now, sea level born, whether from Japan or Great Britain or the United States or anywhere in the world, they all go to altitude now. And one of the people who started that was Frank Shorter, who took the Olympic gold of course, we had a great Olympic effort in 1972, the men's side, of course, with fourth place and ninth place taken, all runners who trained at altitude. But today, you know, just as your guests have commented about the challenge, today the financial side is huge. And it's, you know, just as Coach was saying there about this, our efforts have become pretty recent, where we've been organized, where USA Track and Field and where Nike have all stepped forward to organize our distance runners to train together, just the way Frank Shorter did with the Florida Track Club, the way all the Boston runners did, including Alberto Salazar with the Greater Boston Track Club and Coach Billy Squires back in the 70s and 80s.
Do you think technological investment can do the trick, Bill Rogers? I mean, cryo saunas and low-gravity treadmills, is that a path to victory?
I think I do want to salute Alberto Salazar first and foremost, and Nike for what they are doing, you know, for our athletes, for our Olympic athletes and our distance runners, track athletes, because Alberto probably knows as much about training as anyone as I've ever met in my life or anyone I know. Knows more about it than me. I think he, you know, Alberto is a perfectionist, and he was able to win partly because of that drive. I mean, I knew him in high school. He was kind of a skinny kid from Wayland, Mass.
6'1".
Yeah. But his mind was very strong. He knew what he wanted to do, and he hung out with all these runners from Greater Boston Track Club. He knew what he had to do down the road. Then he went to the University of Oregon, another place where there was a great environment. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what Kenya and Ethiopia has had for 40 years. And we have that in spots, you know, but there's not a lot of other sports or focus on other sports in those nations. We have tremendous numbers of sports that take a lot of focus. Well, Coach was talking about soccer. You know, we do have pretty high-level soccer players in America, very fine soccer players, and that's great. And we do have great distance runners, too. And I think I agree with the coach that there's been tremendous progress the last 5 or 10 years. People like Alberto Salazar played a huge role in that, you know. And
when you were winning marathon after marathon, Bill Rogers, back in the 70s, I mean, you won all 22 big marathons. You won Boston and New York 4 times each. Did you ever think that Americans could go into the kind of slump we've seen in the generation since then? Did it ever occur to you?
No one foresaw the big move by the altitude-born runners, you know, into the sport that came about in the 80s when our sport went professional, early 80s, you know. And so no one really thought about it too much. But we always knew that these top runners were very good, you know, from the days of Kip Kano defeating Jim Ryan at altitude in Mexico City. I don't think it's attitude. I don't think it's willpower. I think it's, you know, your circumstances, where you're at. I think one thing that, you know, the folks who won in the past, perhaps, you know, in a way, our location, I'm from Hartford, Connecticut, and now Massachusetts, so I was in between New York and Boston. It was in my turf. I had a little connection to these races. Alberto Salazar as well. He's from the Boston area. This is a drive for him. Joan Benoit Samuelson, another New Englander. In other words, the Boston Marathon played a huge role in getting a lot of us fired up. Now, will that allow us to win? Not necessarily, but it plays a role, I think.
To Elizabeth in Ludlow, Vermont. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's on your mind?
I had a question about the effect of modern-day running shoes on this, you know, lack of winning in American runners. There's just a few factors that seem to be more than coincidence when it comes to our lack of results and the presence of our modern-day in use of running shoes.
So fancy running shoes and lately these sort of barefoot-style running shoes and all the rest. Scott Douglas, let me come first to you on that. Do people think much about the kind of shoe or barefoot versus a big cushion, you name it? Could that be a piece of the answer?
It would be a piece of the answer in that when American runners start running as teens, like when Dathan Ritzenhain started running, even before he started running, he had spent his life most likely wearing thickly cushioned shoes, which would sort of slightly changed the natural way that your body wants to run. And then when he started running in high school, he's, again, wearing pretty thickly cushioned shoes for most of his training. And, yeah, that's going to encourage sort of the more heel-striking type stance that now Salazar, ironically enough employed by Nike, is trying to get him to undo.
Right.
Whereas, in Kenya, I mean, the stories about Kenyans running to school barefoot are somewhat apocryphal, but they're also grounded in truth. And if you grow up walking and running a few miles a day or several miles a day over dirt, rolling hills, while barefoot, you're going to develop more naturally the good biomechanical underpinnings of running form if it turns out that you then become a runner.
Jennifer Kahn, is Alberto Salazar looking at that with his Oregon project, at what's on or off the foot?
Yeah, you know, they certainly look at shoes. There was a lot of question about the shoe that certainly that Dathan was going to be racing in New York City. I actually don't know how much he emphasizes barefoot training specifically. I would guess he doesn't do a lot with Dathan, because one of the interesting things is that Dathan would probably be a case where he would have, if he were in Kenya and he didn't have access to good shoes, he might have washed out earlier, because he has these sort of finicky feet. He has the metatarsal bones in one foot in particular, the third metatarsal. He tends to get these stress fractures a lot in them. And so he can, you know, we can do stuff with that these days with good shoes and with good orthotics and everything else. You know, but if he were running, you know, barefoot to and fro, he probably just would have been done a while ago.
Bill Rogers, what do you see these days? I mean, it's not 1975 or 7 or 9 anymore. Do shoes make a difference?
Well, I can say some of the best shoes I've run in throughout my 40-year running career were from the 1970s. Of course, I'm older now and nothing seems to work. But, you know, but I will say, you know, I won the Boston Marathon in a pair of Nikes that absolutely had nothing to them. They must have weighed like 5 ounces.
Yeah.
But I was doing 130 miles a week, and I always trained a lot on dirt and grass, and I think that is part of the Kenyan and Ethiopians method to success, is that they do a lot of mileage, and they do a lot of it on rolling hills, which builds your foot as a lever, your push-off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I am a little bit skeptical of 2 months. I was in a race this past weekend down in Springfield, Missouri, Bass Pro Sports Marathon, and I saw this runner I'm running alongside him with, and he's barefoot. I said, whoa. And then we came to the concrete, and he jumped over the grass pretty quick. But I think we are, you know, I think to have strong feet is important. And whether you go to a trainer and you learn how to do that, you know, but I think you want to be careful with the lightweight shoes too. You know, it took me a long time to build up to where I could do that kind of mileage and get away with running in lightweight shoes.
And let's come back to form, where Alberto's pushing so hard. The idea that you might radically change a runner's form and with that run to success. I've got a web comment here from Coach Tom Dedarian, running coach. You may know him. He says, expecting that changing a runner's form would cause a great improvement in racing is wishful thinking, like hoping to find an island of flightless birds just waiting for a coach to teach them how to fly. What about it, Bill? Salazar's going big on form, radical on form. What do you see in that effort?
I think, as I said earlier, when I saw Alberto, he was kind of a skinny kid, though he's still one of the best in the country. You don't have to have a lot of muscle mass in the sport. In fact, too much is a disadvantage. Mainly it's cardiovascular sport. But Alberto did concentrate on weights and became a stronger person. And so the more you can avoid injuries, the more you can have success. And so that's where you get to run on dirt and grass a lot, and you rest a lot. And that's something the Kenyans are doing, and our top runners and the best runners in the world are all doing now more. But I think to have an edge, the altitude edge, and exactly how you cope with that, you know, is going to be a challenge. That's going to always be a challenge for the whole world, the 200 countries in the world that are in distance running. I mean, it's a big sport. But I think we always have success. We always have a Shalane Flanagan or a Dathan Ritzenthein or a Mebka Fazighi. Some young people, all these great coaches out there, always leading our athletes. We might not always win, but the Americans are always in the hunt, and I think that makes our sport great.
I mean, Jennifer, though, the thing that got Salazar's attention was that what success had come to mean for American marathoners. In his day, Bill Rogers' day with us here, it meant winning. And then there they were, you know, watching marathons where an American would come in, you know, somewhere in the top 10, and there'd be celebration. That he's saying, no, not good enough.
Well, I think
I would celebrate the American success at New York City this weekend. We had two guys in the top 10. Only Ethiopia or Kenya matched that.
Mm-hmm.
And on the women's side, Shalane very nearly took the crown in her first marathon.
Yeah.
That's
and in second. Yeah.
She's a great athlete. Right. You know, she's very high level. And
20 seconds off the winning time. That's not much.
Yeah.
What Salazar say to that?
This is a sport where you only get one or two shots a year to do your best.
Yeah.
And I think it's different than the sprints or the mile or most sports where they're out there every other weekend. You can recover quick. This is a different kind of a challenge. This is a long-term challenge. That's why it's great to see USA Track and Field and, you know, people like Alberto who understand that. And the success we've had, people like Solinsky setting a new American record at 10,000 meters, something that was unbelievable. No one thought anyone could run that fast 10 years ago. So a part of it is in the mind of our coaches and our athletes, you know. But the altitude-borne challenge, I think, will be there for the whole rest of the world to consider.
Alberto's mind, Jennifer, seems pretty focused on that number one spot from the way you convey it.
Yeah, I think he and everyone else in his program at the Oregon Project, I actually wanted to check this out. I wanted to see if he was the equivalent of the stage parent who was somehow pushing the athletes. You know, they should be just happy to get third. Every athlete I talked to said, you know, we're not here to get eighth, but we're not even here to get third. You know, the point is we're trying to win this. You shouldn't be going in thinking, well, if I get third, I'm going to feel darn good about myself. You know, you might feel okay about yourself, but you want to go in thinking, you know, I need to be shooting for the top. Like, that's the point of being an elite competitive runner.
There was a time when it happened again and again. Leonard in Litchfield, Connecticut. Leonard, you're on the air.
Thank you. My question was related to your discussion on changing their form or stride. I wanted to know if high endurance sports such as cycling and running, for instance, Lance Armstrong, when he changed his position on the bike, which was difficult, but he did it, he began to win. And I don't think it sounded as hard, but I think it's mind over matter. Is cycling and running similar in that fashion? And the way he changed his form on the bicycle, when he did so, he won. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Leonard. What do you say, Scott? Lance Armstrong shifts on his seat and, you know, starts bringing home the victories. Does running have that same openness?
Running wouldn't have that same if that was why Lance started winning, and that's of course open to debate. If that's why Lance started winning, running doesn't have that sort of tweak a gadget type thing, and that's sort of why people sort of admire Salazar, but sort of think of him as sort of like the weird uncle, you know, who's lovable but a little goofy. That Dathan Ritzenhain, the factor determining whether Dathan Ritzenhain wins the New York City Marathon is not how he holds his thumbs or whether he has a cryo sauna the day before. Cycling sort of has that that mentality and of course, the gadgets that you can do that with. Not so much in running, I would say.
Bill, Alberto's really staking a lot on this. Dathan's dealing with injuries because of it and high hopes. I mean, form at base, how far would you try to tweak it with a great runner?
No, I agree with Tom Dedarian and with Scott that, you know, I believe it's partly genetic. Your foot strike, I believe, is genetic primarily. And that is just my gut feeling about it in a way. But I think you can become stronger primarily through your training. I believe training is everything, and avoiding injuries is everything. And Alberto knows that too. And he is a smart, smart coach. I mean, look at the success he's had. I don't think the form issue is the key. I really don't. You know, that's not the key. The key is your attitude and your training and your teammates and your coach. These are the keys, you know. But Alberto wants to win. And I share that feeling too. I mean, I love seeing American success, you know. But I just think that it's harder than ever today. And how can any athlete from any country born at sea level go up against the sea level born athletes? This is a conundrum, a tough one.
Yeah, Jennifer quotes Salazar saying, "If we don't change your biomechanics, I don't think I can get you there." Nora in Barrington, Rhode Island. Nora, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
As a dietitian, I think we have to think about the fuel that is consumed by our athletes. And the diet in Kenya is quite different. They use different grains, the same in Ethiopia. And I think here in the U.S., since the 80s, the food has been containing much more preservatives and gluten, for instance. And this is something I think we have to look at.
Could I say something?
Absolutely, Scott. The food itself, the fuel.
Yeah, so like I said, I spent a month in Kenya six years ago, and I would say that for all the reasons put forward for Kenyan distance running success, diet would be sort of they succeed despite it. The food is of course, fresh, but they basically eat cornmeal and cornmeal and barely drink water and get about 30% of their calories through heavily sugared tea. So,
but they win.
Yeah, so I'm saying it's that I would say that the bad U.S. diet, which I would not argue, of course, U.S. diet is horrible, but that's not why the Kenyans are better, because their diet is even worse than ours.
Bill Rogers, what do you say? Could there be something in that very lean diet and grain diet that our caller describes that advantages Kenyans, or no way?
I think diet plays a key role in distance running. That's true. I agree with the caller in that sense, but also, you know, I understand what Scott's saying. I spoke with Catherine DeRaber recently, the four-time winner of Boston and multiple winner at Chicago and so forth, and one of the greatest women of all time. She told me a great story about how the Kenyan kids in the inner cities, you know, in Nairobi and so forth, are getting heavy. You know, they're not doing good, and they're getting bused to school, and they're eating the junk food, you know. But yet, in the countryside, up in the Rift Valley, in small villages or towns, you know, it's different, and you live a healthier life. So I think lifestyle plays a role. You know, being active as a kid, you know, that's been talked about. That I think that plays a huge role, too.
Jennifer, lean makes a big difference here. You described, you know, Dathan as incredibly lean. What you say, like it looks like you'd be at home on the veldt, a sleek human oryx.
Yeah, and I think I mostly just agree with what I certainly defer to Scott and Bill on the nutrition issue. I don't know as much about it. The one thing I'll say is that at least in my time with Dathan, he was eating extraordinarily well. I mean, whatever the diet of the ordinary American is, you know, these are marathoners. They're trying to have, you know, 0.5% body fat. He's not out there eating, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken. He, you know, when we went to lunch, was eating brown rice and kale and, you know, I think stuff that probably many of the Kenyans might be quite, you know, happy to get that many healthy calories.
Look down the road with us then, Jennifer, at what a lot of people are working on this. Bill Rogers is working on it at his own running center and many others. But when you look at Alberto, who you've been focused on very closely here, it must have been disappointing to see Dathan Ritzenhines, you know, finish in New York. I mean, a great time, but still not that win he's looking for. What's he see down the road, Alberto?
Exactly. I think he probably was disappointed with New York. I think they're probably looking ahead to the 2012 Olympics and trying to train him up for that. And in terms of the bigger picture, you know, I think what everyone's been saying is that it really is—it's a problem. We have, you know, we're coming from behind, and so we need to figure something out to overcome, whether it's genetics or whether it's being born at altitude. And there's a big debate over what the best way to do that is. Is the secret going to be changing form? Is the secret going to be taking advantage of technology and the money we can throw at this problem? Is it going to be getting more runners so we have more numbers and we can have a bit of a renaissance of running the way we had in the 70s and 80s before everyone went off to, you know, as much to basketball and football? Yeah, and I'm not sure that anyone knows, but I definitely credit Alberto Salazar with trying all those things. He's trying to bring us back.
Jennifer Kahn's great piece in The New Yorker is the perfect stride. Bill, what do you say? You're going to be out recruiting long-distance runners, I don't know, high mountain-born in Wyoming and Colorado and Utah, the High Sierras? Is that where you're going to find your winner?
A lot of our top runners have come from Utah. Of course, quite a few have come from Michigan, like Dathan. I think it's the schools there, the coaches, and the attitude of success that they have. I think that plays a huge role, the same way it's happened at University of Oregon over the years. So tradition is a big thing. And that's a challenge. We have to overcome the Ethiopian and Kenyan tradition. Though I take my hat off to them, they're great champions. But I think we, you know, I think the runners like Dathan, he's a great athlete. But I would say one thing about the marathon in particular. You have to expect to fail, too. I dropped out of 8 marathons in my quest to win. I mean, sometimes you get beat up. I thought he ran a strong race, but I think he's going to run much better in the future.
The great Bill Rogers dropped out of 8, but 1:22. It's been great to have you with us today. Bill Rogers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Scott Douglas, senior editor at Running Times. Scott, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
Jennifer Kahn in Berkeley, California, thanks to you as well and all of our listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being here. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.